Welcome to Ingest, the podcast series designed for primary care and brought to you by the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology. My name is Charlie Andrews, a GP with an extended role in gastroenterology based near Bath. As always, please remember that this is an educational podcast. It is not designed to replace your clinical judgment or any guidelines. In this episode, I'm speaking with Matt Warren and Richard Thompson about advice and guidance. They've set up a fantastic service in Northumbria, which we're going to be hearing about. We'll also be talking about common advice and guidance queries that they see and how they manage them. And we'll be looking at what makes a good advice and guidance query. So what sort of bits of information are really helpful to include in any advice and guidance query that you put through to the gastroenterology team to help them to make an appropriate decision and support us in many ways as best they can to manage patients who have gastrointestinal conditions and symptoms. So without further ado, let's get into the episode. So I'm joined by Matt Warren and Richard Thompson today. We're going to be talking about advice and guidance, and I'm really excited to discuss this with them. Why don't we start by doing some introductions? Matt, do you want to introduce yourself to the audience today?
Yeah, hi, Charlie. So I'm Matt Warren. I'm a consultant gastroenterologist in Northumbria Healthcare Trust. So we're based up in the northeast of England. I've been a consultant for about 20 years here with principally an interest in sort of general gastroenterology, but also therapeutic endoscopy. So my clinic experience has really been general gastroenterology, and that's what I've got more interested in as the years have gone by.
Brilliant. Thank you. And Richard?
Hi, Charlie. I'm Richard Thompson. I'm a consultant gastroenterologist in Northumbria. I've been here about 25 years. Did some of my training down your way. My role is kind of split 50-50 between clinical and undergraduate education. My clinical role now is really confined to bowel cancer screening and advice and guidance. But I, like Matt, I regard myself as a generalist.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. So we're going to be talking about advice and guidance today. And we spoke a few months ago about a system that you set up in Northumbria, where you are looking at how to manage increasing demand for your services in a more innovative way. And I found it really inspiring and really interesting to talking to you about it. And actually, there's quite a few sort of crossovers between primary and secondary care here, because in primary care, we're dealing with an awful lot of demand at the moment, and GP practices are trying to work out how to manage that significant demand from patients. And in some ways, we're looking at digital triage systems and providing kind of advice to patients rather than appointments in some cases when that's appropriate. And actually, when I was speaking to you, Matt and Richard, it felt like that was a similar system that you were running in your area. You were looking at how you can manage demand better. So I think it'd be really helpful to start off by describing what service you've set up. So Matt, do you think you could tell us about the service you've set up and why you did that? What was your motivation?
Yeah, so I think it came down to speed, really, of trying to get things done for patients as quickly as possible. And we live in a very widespread area geographically. So to drive for patients from to the hospital would often have involved long journeys. We all know what a nightmare it is to get parked at hospitals and all that kind of thing. So logistically, very difficult for patients to get to us. They were often having to wait very many weeks to see us. And not infrequently, we would find that patients were triaged into the wrong clinic, or they were seeing us when really what they needed was a cholecystectomy or something like that, something we couldn't help them with. And so we were spending sort of the first 5 minutes of an appointment apologizing for how long patients had had to wait to see us for their appointment, and then heart sink, where we would realize that we couldn't actually help them with the problem. And I guess on top of that, we were also finding more and more patients who we felt we could have supported or offered treatment for in a very remote way, that kind of remote consultation that you're mentioning there, Charlie. And I guess as a for instance, we've always seen a lot of patients who have really quite severe diarrhea related to some of their very common medications like lansoprazole or metformin or similar. So I think it was about speed. It was about trying to see the patients in hospital who needed that kind of care, trying to make that as quick as possible with a target of 4 weeks, but also offering advice to primary care rapidly to manage patients near to home where that was suitable. And advice and guidance, I think, really was a tool to try and deliver that rather than an outcome in and of itself. So we felt that having senior consultants or senior clinicians looking at GP referrals at point of referral would allow us, first of all, to sort of triage the patient to the right clinic or the right test on the first occasion. But it would also identify patients who, in sort of concert with our GP colleagues, could be managed much more quickly close to home, but only, of course, where that was suitable. So advice and guidance really wasn't the be all and end all of what we were after, but we found it to be a really useful tool to try and improve the speed of getting consultant experience, consultant advice to patients in whatever format was most appropriate.
So I think that the pandemic definitely accelerated our thinking on this, didn't it? Kind of got us thinking that as we switched to telephone and video consultation, and we started to unearth the way some of our waiting lists worked, we realized it's kind of, in some ways, it's quite clunky and one size fits all. And had a real sense that there was a smarter solution to this. So we were motivated by a sense that we could definitely do better. And you're right, it has been at times a kind of uphill struggle, but I think overall we've encountered less resistance than you might imagine. I think there was a natural suspicion, I think not helped by the national narrative around advice and guidance, that we might be just pushing work back into primary care. And we have been very careful to avoid that. I think we've learned to be careful with our language and to kind of read between the lines of a referral and not antagonize already fraught relationships between GP and the patient by being sensitive and flexible in terms of what we're offering. We have been very careful not to sort of slam doors shut, if you like, so offer advice, but with a bit of safety netting or, an invitation to come back and ask us more if plan A doesn't work out or if the patient remains concerned. I would say it hasn't been as difficult as you might imagine.
And on that note, what's the feedback been like? Have you had much feedback from primary care colleagues around that?
Yeah, so we would love as much rich feedback around that as we can get, really. We have, as Matt, I think we'll tell you, we've done a little bit of formal surveying of our users, of the GPs, and broadly speaking, that was very reassuring. I mean, bottom line is everybody thinks it's a good thing and it's helpful for patient care, but there is a recognition that in some cases it's adding to workload. And so that was very helpful to us, because I think we recognised we were not on a knife edge exactly, but it was a sensitive situation, and if we changed our behaviour, too much, we could antagonise people. What we'd love to know is how this is landing with patients. I mean, we have sort of soft intel from our GP colleagues and friends, and we have a GP executive director in the trust who's been a really fantastic conduit for us in terms of getting us information that we need. But we are thinking about how to more formally explore the experience of the patients themselves.
And I would echo what Richard said, is that it's taken a while, and obviously there's been quite a few bumps in the road, and we're really mindful about how much pressure primary care GPs are under, and very mindful that advice and guidance can be done well and it can be done badly, can't it? And we've really sort of tried to seek feedback from primary care on what advice and guidance done well is. And you know, what we hear, and maybe you correct us on this, Charlie, what we hear is that if we get the replies back to primary care quickly, if they're kind of friendly and reasonable and don't give primary care a shopping list of ridiculous numbers of secondary care tasks to do, and if they're kind of open to further discussion, then in the main, our GP colleagues are willing to meet us halfway on that. And we surveyed two of our big local sort of practice consortia and got some fantastic feedback. I don't mean necessarily in terms of positive, but in terms of really rich feedback from primary care. And unsurprisingly, it was felt that that advice and guidance put work back into primary care. And you know, we can't get away from that. We are often asking GPs to do some additional blood tests or start a new treatment that otherwise would have been initiated in secondary care. But actually 95% of our GPs, so it was 20 partners who answered this survey, so 95% felt that it was beneficial for patients, that overall it was a better offer than we'd given before, and that it did improve collaborative working between primary and secondary care. And we've been very sort of careful to go out into primary care, into GP surgeries, into PCN meetings. We've even sort of braved LMC conversations, because I think that relationship really underpins this kind of work. You know, it may be that GPs don't always like what we ask them to do, but if they know who I am and they know that they can come back to me and say, look, I'm not really sure about this, I think that gets us a long way. So what we've really learned, and perhaps Richard would agree, is that this is a very relational exercise. You know, primary and secondary care, managerial and clinician, these things absolutely underpin it. And just to sort of finish the thought, Charlie, about that, we're also able now to go out to primary care and sort of say, well, actually, as a matter of fact, in the last year, the number of advice and guidance referrals you've sent us have doubled. So, well, it increased by 80%. So our numbers are going up and we're offering more and more advice to primary care. And our waiting times are the next best thing to zero at the moment. And, you know, we were talking before this that I've been going through some referrals this morning because we've got clinic slots in the next couple of days. So, you know, if a GP had contacted me this morning and said, I'm really up against it with a patient, I could have got them into clinic tomorrow. And by the way, the GP isn't going to have months or years of chasing appointments, managing patients who are getting sicker on waiting lists, all that kind of thing. So I guess what we hoped was that in the totality for gastro, that we were taking some work, not taking some work away, but maybe kind of avoiding GPs having to do appointment chasing, whatnot. We were offering advice at an early stage, which might enable them to shut down unnecessary lines of investigation. For example, liver screens in minor LFT derangements, that kind of thing, where usually we would say, we support you not to do that. But also, you know, if a GP was really in trouble, we can get their patients seen incredibly quickly and take away that anxiety that GPs may have. Well, this could take 6 months for the patient to be seen. You know, what the heck do I do? So we hope that in the round that was maybe better for the patients because of that speed, but not entirely negative to GPs. That's what we hope anyway.
Mm. I think it's really interesting and refreshing talking to you both, because I feel like you do really understand primary care and the challenges, and you've really thought about how your innovation will land in primary care. And the amount of work that you say that you've done in order to engage with primary care organisations and clinicians is brilliant. And, you know, it's just really exciting and really interesting. And it really bridges that gap between primary and secondary care. I was going to ask, perhaps, Richard, you could answer this one around how it's been received in secondary care, And Matt, you've already talked a bit about waiting times, but you know, what are your waiting lists looking like? Because I know that in some areas they're really long to get a secondary care appointment in gastroenterology. How's it impacted on the service you can provide?
Yeah, so presently there are five of us in the team doing this work. It's quite hard work, and we regard it as kind of proper expert work that requires kind of focus, and you've got to do it in the right frame of mind, and it's not something to be sort of snatched between other jobs. So as Matt's alluded to, the numbers continue to escalate, so it's not inconsiderable. But I think that you speak for the whole team that we find it professionally satisfying, because we feel like we are deploying our expertise in a way that is really genuinely useful for the GP and for the patient, and that it is saving months of suffering and perhaps rancor. So it feels like a good thing to be doing. And there have been some significant spin-off benefits, really. I mean, we recognized that a number of our colleagues weren't getting to endoscopy enough, and their numbers were reaching the point where it was a governance issue. And by freeing up clinic space, and we've even been able to shut down some clinics, that we've allowed consultants to get their endoscopy numbers back up. There have been big benefits for training. We have had senior trainees who felt a bit underutilized, and they've been able to do lots of follow-up clinics under kind of remote supervision. And so that's been a sort of win-win for us. And we've now got, because we've got the headspace, we have a dedicated teaching clinic, which has a proper template with the consultant being a sort of supernumerary trainer with proper time built in for briefing and debriefing. So morale in the team is good, and we've had a real purple patch of recruitment, where we've been the local trust of choice for the new graduates coming off the production line. So it has been it's been a good thing all around.
And I think, Richard, Charlie, in terms of offer to GPs and to the community, I think what we definitely felt was that we had to get the kind of service under control. That was the first thing, that waiting times were too long and so on. And now we've kind of got there with that. We're looking to see what we can offer to the population that might be a little bit different. So we send a consultant and a nurse out to a local drug and alcohol treatment center with a fibro scanner, just to try and get some outreach into a hard to reach group. We've set up a satellite kind of liver clinic in one of the areas of high deprivation, and we're imminently, although administratively this has been quite difficult with the prison service, we're about to we hope to launch a service into some of the local prison populations, who are obviously very hard to reach and often underserved, aren't they? So I think it's giving us a bit of headspace to kind of think of the value added that we can do. How, in a way, can secondary care not sort of do the work of primary care, because nobody's suggesting that, but how far can we reach into primary care and sort of offer support, help, just kind of come up alongside our primary care colleagues and back them up when they need to, or fit into some gaps with particularly difficult to reach patient groups. So it's just given us a little bit of breathing space. And I think you'll know this from primary care, won't you? I think if you're spending all your energy just to sort of keep your head above water, that's a nightmare situation to be in. But we know from talking to local GPs who've been absolutely fantastic in terms of collaborative working, that a little bit of headspace and suddenly people are doing some really interesting and innovative things. And we really hoped in our small way that we were going to be relieving some burden from GPs in managing their waiting lists and all that kind of thing. So there's been lots of opportunities, as Richard says.
It's great. And we're now going to move on to slightly more clinical aspects of this episode. And we're going to dig further into some of the things that you see and come across when you are running your advice and guidance. So we had a look at a list of quite common advice and guidance queries, and I thought we could look at them together, if that's okay. You mentioned that you get quite a lot of dyspepsia-related queries. Richard, perhaps, do you want to talk a bit about kind of what are the common dyspepsia and reflux-related advice and guidance queries you get? And maybe talk about how you approach them.
Yeah, sure. And you know, we're aware that dyspepsia makes up a big part of you know, consulting burden in primary care. And obviously, you know, there's a lot of anxiety often in the back of the mind of the patient, and sometimes in the GP, that they might be missing something serious. And I think you know, with the expertise and experience of in the specialty over many years, it is possible for us to make more confident risk assessments based on, you know, age and the information that we have available, and also looking at the patient's consulting behavior over time. So there's a big difference between a genuinely new symptom and a kind of recurrence of a sort of persistent problem. We get a lot of queries about so-called refractory reflux. So patients with reflux symptoms have been given a PPI, but they are having breakthrough symptoms or incomplete control. And, you know, I guess conventionally you go down the route of, you know, switching PPIs and doubling up the dose and adding in H2 blockers at night and so on. But my take is on reflux is that very often we're dealing with patients who are significantly overweight, and that is that's what's driving the symptoms. And, you know, so my advice in that situation is that, you know, this is not going to improve until lifestyle is tackled. It's interesting that often, you know, BMI is not included in the referral, and whether that's because people are conscious of, you know, not being prejudicial or worried about that the, you know, the patient's going to see these letters. But, you know, it does involve a bit of a manual trawl of the data that we have to find the patient's weight. To me, it's a positive thing, really, to rather than to medicalize it and put the patient through, you know, cycles of reinvestigation, is actually to recognize, you know, what is the likely driving factor. And it's often having other adverse outcomes as well. So a really common situation is the overweight, hypertensive patient on amlodipine with reflux. And so there, the weight is contributing both to the reflux and to the hypertension, and the amlodipine, because it relaxes the lower esophageal sphincter as well as blood vessels, is actually making the reflux worse. So you can, it's an opportunity to sort of demedicalize and refocus on lifestyle.
That's really helpful, thanks. Matt, thinking a bit about lower GI symptoms, I imagine that you get quite a few queries about people with sort of persistent abdominal pain or diarrhea related issues, and probably a number of different tests have been done. I just wonder if you could talk about some of the common advice and guidance queries you get around those sort of symptoms and how you approach them.
Yeah, I think we're lucky in gastro, really, that we've got a lot of very useful pre-referral diagnostics available: FIT, calprotectin, TTG, that kind of thing. And you know, we're seeing increasingly that FIT is meaning that patients with lower GI symptoms are not sort of accepted onto lower GI two-week wait pathways. And some of the national guidance is really that FIT negative change of bowel habit should be managed in primary care. But of course, that leaves the GPs in the tricky situation of thinking, well, you know, that's all well and good, they haven't got colorectal cancer, but what have they gotten? What do I do about it? So, you know, I think, Charlie, you'll know more than me as a practicing GP, that there's sort of raft of persistent physical symptoms, functional conditions, there's an absolute wave of these problems coming through. So we're seeing a lot of irritable bowel type problems. I think GPs are really good at recognizing this and really good at sort of treating it. And we probably only see a tiny percentage of the total community burden, but every so often, you know, we get Well, quite often, actually, we get referrals for irritable bowel. And then I think in that case, it's very useful to understand what it is that's going on that's making the GP concerned. You know, is it that they're unsure about the diagnosis, which is very legitimate? Is it that the patient is unsure about the diagnosis, or there's something slightly atypical? So I think, you know, in an advice and guidance context, we're very happy to discuss these cases. And sometimes it's about the GP saying, well, look, I think this is irritable bowels, but you know, this is just kind of what's in my mind, family history of IBD or something like that. So I think we see a lot of functional stuff. I think we see a lot of drug side effect, especially things like metformin, you know, and a common thing we suggest that, you know, many GPs will be doing anyway, change to a modified release preparation or stop the metformin if at all possible. Make sure patients aren't using lots of sugar substitutes with a sorbitol, you know, laxative-like effect, all that kind of thing. PPI, of course, is a massive or hugely common prescription, isn't it? But also lansoprazole, PPI, very common cause of diarrheal side effects, SSRI, of course. So I think even things like beta blockers. So a lot of the very commonly prescribed medications. So I think what we find is the situation that the sort of big hitters have really been ruled out by pre-referral investigations, cancer, IBD, celiac disease, things like that. And then GPs are wondering, what next? And often in that situation, I think our recommendation is to move away from diagnostics and more towards treatments, isn't it? I think it's more of a dietary modification. It's judicious use of loperamide. It's dealing with psychosocial factors, but also keeping in mind the small number of conditions that wouldn't flag up on those tests. So your GP colleagues probably thinking about things like bile acid diarrhea or perhaps microscopic colitis, you know, in middle-aged women who've been on PPI or NSAID or something like that. And we're quite commonly asked about small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, which seems to be quite a sort of hot topic at the moment. And I think that's a tricky one because our tests aren't really very good for it. And it, my very limited experience, tends to be a condition of perhaps older immunocompromised people, people with structural problems of the gut, previous operations, for example. And sometimes these days, all we recommend is an empirical course of antibiotics, recognizing that, you know, the placebo response might be quite high to that. So I think SIBO is a tricky one and a good one for advice and guidance. And I think that's always the nice thing about having advice and guidance is that we discuss these ones, don't we? That's not to say that we need to see them, but if a GP says, I'm worried about bile acid diarrhea, well, let's have a conversation about it. And if they need a CCAT scan, we'll sort it out. So I think, I think we're very sympathetic to primary care colleagues in terms of they refer in with a symptom and they either get the bounce back because the FIT is negative or they come in for a colonoscopy, the colonoscopy is negative, and the patient's still got diarrhea, and nobody's any further forward. So I think A and G, we hope, can really support those areas. That's a long answer, Charlie. I'm sorry about
No,
that.
it's really good. And I was just, you know, a couple of things that came out. One of them was, do GPs commonly kind of give you a question, or do you find that you're sometimes looking at an advice and guidance and asking the question yourself? What is the purpose of this advice and guidance query, Richard?
Yeah, so you mentioned at the beginning, you know, we might cover, you know, what are the elements of a really good inquiry, and obviously also, you know, what does a good response look like? And I think what you just mentioned there is really important. And as Matt's alluded to, you know, knowing, you know, who holds the anxiety, for example, is this, you know, the GP's gut instinct is that this is functional, but they're struggling to reassure the patient, or is it that there's something about this presentation that has got the GP anxious? It's really helpful to know, you know, what you're being asked, and I appreciate that, you know, when the patients are reading these letters, that, you know, that may not be that straightforward to do, but the more we can kind of be clear about what the problem is, the better able we are to answer it. And I think, you know, Matt's mentioned functional illness, and you know, we know from the data that, you know, upwards of 10% of GP consultations, you know, the patient does not have identifiable organic pathology, and in outpatients across the board, it's probably more like 50%. So, you know, we are seeing a lot of functional illness, and of course, that causes a lot of misery, and these patients consult repeatedly and often shuttle around between, you know, surgery and gynecology and neurology and gastro. And so I think that having enough psychosocial information in the referral is really helpful. I mean, we the quality of records now we do have, is certainly in Northumbria, we can actually directly access mental health records, for example, but that's quite laborious to trawl through records and put all the pieces together. So having more psychosocial information up front, I think, is really helpful, because it's not about prejudging the problem, but it is helpful to us to offer an empathic response. And sometimes you can say, look, obviously this patient's got a lot on their plate, or they've not had the easiest life, and I think it's helpful to acknowledge that, and probably helpful for the patient to see it.
And Matt, do you use advice and guidance as a way of educating primary care as well? So do you find it's helpful as a way of kind of supporting the learning and things for primary care colleagues?
Yeah, I think educating, I guess we don't want to sort of, you know, suppose that GPs need educating, if that makes sense. So but I think, you know, it's if we get a reply, let's say, or request rather, for some advice on a gallbladder polyp, and we get lots of referrals for that, there are some really, really good guidelines, but it just may be that the GP has 10,000 sets of guidelines that they've got to look through. So how on earth could we expect them to look at something as small print as gallbladder polyps? So we would kind of reply and say, you know, such and such a thing with this polyp, and by the way, here's a web link to the guidelines. And I guess what we hope is that GP, and you know, I think this is what we see, is that the GPs will say, okay, well, they've helped me this time, but actually next time I know where to look, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So Charlie, that's been our kind of intention, is that you reply to the specific question, and then you also try and add in a little bit of stuff around it. And as Richard says, we found out a while ago, perhaps we were a little bit shocked when we found it out, that some of our replies get uploaded onto the GP patient record, and if the patient has access to that, they read it, and we were a bit like, oh, what have we, you know, just having to sense check that we've been polite and all that kind of thing. But actually, on reflection, I think it's great, because it gives us an opportunity to, maybe as Richard says, not sort of educate the patient, but put something in there like a web link to some NHS guidance, self-management, or even if we've got the sense from the GP letter that the GP knows what's going on, but the patient just needs that little bit of kind of reassurance, you know, it's very easy for us to say, you know, I've been through all the records and I completely agree with your assessment, and try and give the GP that kind of air cover, if that makes sense. So I think there's an educational aspect, yes, perhaps, and we try and maximize that when we can. But there's definitely something to do with the GP patient relationship, which we have to be very mindful of. And you know, we probably didn't say at the start, but which I think is helpful to mention, is that we will have all the old records open when we're doing this. So as well as seeing the referral, we'll have our ICE systems, you know, so our electronic results and clinical letters system, we have access to the GP record through HIE. So I think you can only do this properly, if you like, or thoroughly, if you've got two or three screens running with all this information and taking that kind of longitudinal view of what's been going on, which often enables us, as Richard says, to pick up these kind of patterns of behavior. And because we've got time in, you know, we have built in time in our job plans, which is a lovely situation to be in, we probably have more time to take that kind of step back and look at those things. And just as often as suggesting treatment, I would say, Richard, I don't know if you'd agree, that more often than suggesting treatment, we're suggesting that this is kind of okay and it's been going on a while and you don't need to worry about the gamma GT of 90 or the or the whatever, because you know it's been investigated before, it's not pathological. So yeah, I think the dialogue bit, as well as education, yes, dialogue has really been the key bit, and I think our referrals, the quality of the referrals really reflects that. I think, you know, definitely when we've worked in other places where referrals aren't vetted by secondary care, why would the GP spend ages crafting a really skilled referral? Because nobody's going to read it. And what a waste of a GP's time to do that. But I think the dialogue, the quality of our referrals is really good and almost always starts with the term, you know, can we have a discussion about, or what's your advice on this? And it, you know, I kind of really like that way of communicating.
Richard, would you like to give us some input and thoughts around the that topic as well, the education side and replying?
Yeah, just in respect of education, I just wanted to add that, you know, for us, it's been a it's quite good CPD and a bit of a learning curve, because through this process, you become a bit of a magpie. You sort of spot useful resources, and we have a sort of shared file where we keep them. And so, there's some really excellent patient facing resources, for example, on bile acid malabsorption produced by Guts Charity. And I sometimes send people links to the ZOE podcast, and sometimes we'll send, you know, original papers if the GP's inquired about something which I think might be a rare but possible side effect of a drug, for example. And whether people choose to, you know, look at them or not, it's quite a simple matter to kind of send that as part of your reply. And I think in this era where, you know, patients do want to educate themselves around their condition, if they can access those resources, then that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, no, fully agree. Can we look at one more potentially common area that anecdotally feels like it's a very common area, and actually when we were communicating it sounded like it was. Richard, do you want to talk a bit about sort of abnormal liver function tests and MASLD? Do you get many queries around abnormal liver function? I'd have thought that you might do.
You know, we're doing more liver function tests than ever before, aren't we? So we're generating a lot of data, some of which will light up red, and that understandably causes anxiety. And there is on the one hand, you know, we are obviously keen to pick up serious liver disease early, to intervene, to, you know, get people under surveillance and, you know, make sure people get transplanted and so on. But that's a tiny, tiny piece of the pizza. You know, the vast majority of patients with, you know, mildly abnormal liver function tests will have fatty liver, and that is better viewed as a lifestyle problem, which is very much best managed in primary care. As well as the resource implications of unnecessary investigation, it does generate anxiety. And so I think advice and guidance is a really good place to handle this particular problem. But, you know, by early reassurance, as Matt said, the kind of isolated rise in gamma GT is virtually, I think I can say, never significant. So we can kind of reassure people early on and prevent that kind of cascade of investigations. Obviously, fatty liver is an epidemic, and there's a subgroup of those patients who go on to develop, you know, more advanced liver disease, and we do want to know who those patients are, and we want to see them. But really, picking up advanced fatty liver disease is about putting people into hepatocellular carcinoma surveillance, and so it does seem need to be a bit of realistic medicine about this. So if you've got a 85-year-old with abnormal LFTs, and okay, you could do a fibro scan and it might confirm that they've got fibrosis, but practically, you know, this patient is not going to be suitable for, and is probably not going to appreciate, you know, 6 monthly blood tests and ultrasound, and is almost certainly not going to be fit for any intervention if they do develop HCC. So why put them through that? We have we're lucky enough to have a new hepatologist who has been really dynamic in transforming our service, and so we do have a very good outpatient liver service, but we, through advice and guidance, try not to, you know, swamp that service with patients who just don't need to be seen.
Do you want to add anything to that one, Matt?
Yeah, I think Richard's right. And I guess we talked earlier about how lucky we are in GI to have these pre-referral investigations. But also, I think they can lead to that kind of situation we get in hospital where we check a D-dimer on somebody and it comes back positive. And then you're like, oh, why did I check that? What do I do now? I wish I hadn't checked, you know, they haven't really got a PE. And I think things like Fib4 scores, I think calprotectins, I think blanket use of tumor markers as a kind of a fishing expedition. I think these things have to be done very, very carefully, don't they? Because we've all been in the situation of wishing we'd never done a test in the first place. And I think fit and things is similar, isn't it? You know, repeating a fit after somebody's just had a colonoscopy 3 months before or something like that. But I know these are difficult situations, aren't they? And I really sympathize with primary care that, you know, for whatever reason, a test has been done, and once it's done, it can't be undone. But I think we can help to sort of avoid unnecessary lines of investigation by providing that air cover to primary care and saying, you know, we're with you on this. You know, we agree this shouldn't be followed on. And I think with the liver, with MASLD, I think that's exactly the same, isn't it? You know, I think it's very easy to get focused on the Fib4 score. It's very easy to get focused on the FibroScan. And if they've got F3 fibrosis, it's very easy to latch onto that. But actually, the cardiovascular risk for the patient probably far outweighs their liver risk, doesn't it? And it can... it can sometimes be a bit more difficult to see the wood for the trees and realize that this is a kind of whole body metabolic problem. And actually the liver is the least of it. So yes, we see a lot of it. Usually we ask GPs to do a Fib4 in the community, and we have direct access to FibroScan for patients who have appropriate Fib4 scores, and GPs request that directly. We set that up a while ago, and then we arranged to see people who've got F4 disease. We took a decision in COVID that F3 and below we wouldn't see. We would ask our primary care colleagues to monitor that in the community. I know different secondary care settings do that differently, don't they? And hepatologists will often see F3 for research purposes and stuff like that. But we limited it to F4.
Brilliant. Thank you for that. We are coming towards the end of the episode. So what I really want to do before we finish is I want to know what a good advice and guidance query looks like from your perspective. You've seen lots of them coming across your desk and you've responded to lots and lots. What sort of things really help you when you're assessing that query?
Doing it in such a way that we can really understand, you know, what the problem is. I guess effectively put ourselves in your shoes to understand the context, you know, who's anxious, to make the kind of, if the GP can make their kind of diagnostic thinking clear, then that helps us to, you know, provide an answer which is going to be helpful. I think having the GP's hunch about, you know, what this person is like, you know, how, you know, is this somebody that you rarely see? Is this somebody that's in your surgery every week? Is this somebody who's you know, remarkably fit for their biological age, or is it somebody who's, you know, in a care home and really frail, or, you know, really reluctant to have any further investigation? All of that really helps. And the opposite of that would be, you know, being presented with an abnormal blood test or some radiology with no clinical context. So you've got no sense of, you know, what sort of person this is. So plenty of human detail. And I do think that, you know, where the pattern is very much of persistent physical symptoms, then we need enough psychosocial information to almost to allow us to kind of bring that into our formulation, because it can feel a bit uncomfortable having to go through all that information and then put that into the answer when that none of that was included. So personally, I would like much more psychosocial detail where that's likely to be relevant.
Your thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think, you know, again, we're mindful that crafting these referrals takes time. And, you know, we're mindful that time is something that GPs don't have. But I think it's not just us being sort of setting unnecessary gatekeeping rules. I think we can offer better advice in return if we understand what we're being asked to do. So I echo everything Richard said, and would just kind of go back to the thing that I was saying right at the start of this, Charlie, that I got interested in this because of trying to get people to treatment as fast as possible. And so I think things that allow us to do that, is the GP willing to manage this in primary care with advice? Does the patient need to be seen? In which case, why? And what would be the best format? Would they be suitable for telephone? Would they be suitable for face-to-face? You know, is this somebody in a care home that can't get up in the morning kind of thing? And actually, we'd be better ringing their daughter. But I also think that what Richard said is exactly right. I think that kind of value-added intuition, GP expertise stuff is so important. And when you read it, you just really get the flavour of what's going on. And, you know, I know one of the concerns about advice and guidance is that, you know, GPs may say, well, look, sometimes I just want somebody to be seen. And I think that's absolutely legitimate. And I think if a GP gives us a good letter and says, look, I know you might read this one and say, why do they want this person to be seen? But there's just something going on, and I've seen this person for years, and you know, I just need your backup. You know, that's the kind of thing we'll go, well, of course. And because we've got that short waiting time, we can do that quickly. And so I think in a way that I hope that GPs would value Richard and our sort of cumulative experience and whatever, we absolutely value it coming back, if that makes sense. So, yeah, it doesn't need to be a long thing. Just give us the question, give us the background, give us the expectation and the ask, and you know, we'll try our best to sort of address that with our replies.
We're coming to the end now, and it's been really interesting. I'm so inspired by what you're doing. I think it's really bridging that gap, as I said, between primary and secondary care. It's really enhancing pathways, getting patients to the right person at the right time, which I think is really important for our patients. And you talked about patients sort of coming back to general practice while waiting on long waiting lists. We see that a lot in primary care, and I think this sort of service can really help to smooth out that process for the patient and really just make GPs feel more supported, which I think is great. I always ask at the end of the episode if that sort of leave you with the opportunity to have any top tips for GPs. Now, I don't know if you have any top tips that, you know, we've covered loads there. There might be a few little bits that you want to pull out as take home messages, or any sort of final thoughts that you want to give to our audience before we finish. I'm going to allow you the last word on this one.
I think the relationships between clinicians are key to this. And I think that the way that the system is set up at the moment, which is no fault of anybody's, has sort of driven us into two silos, if you like. And We all talk about the good old days of the grand round and when we all used to meet up and things like you're too young, Charlie, but those days are long gone, aren't they? So I think, my encouragement to clinicians in secondary care would be get out into primary care, try and get into PCN meetings, get yourself into education sessions, just put yourself out there and accept that there's a lot of, there's a lot of stress in that kind of in that interface between primary and secondary care at the moment. But the only way to break that down is to kind of put your crash helmet on and get out there. And I guess GPs, similarly, I think consultants really do want to work with GPs for the kind of to improve the service. But it's a bit like trolling people on X or whatever. If you don't know who someone is, it's very easy to get angry. So that's a very kind of long-winded way of saying just try and get out and build those relationships. And they won't always be easy and you can't do it with everybody, but make a start. And it really does reap rewards, I think.
So through this process, I agree with Matt, it's been a learning curve for us and it has really increased our empathy for the work that you do in primary care. And I British general practice has a proud tradition and you are in the best position to manage the vast majority of these patients and we feel that what we are doing is trying to empower you and trying to alleviate some of the anxiety that may come from the public health messaging and the kind of pressure for everybody to be on pathways and to be kind of put through this machine in secondary care, and as Matt says, sometimes spat out the other end none the wiser. So my advice to GPs is to trust your judgment and if your gut instinct is this patient is not unwell, then that really counts for a lot, and if we can help by providing a bit of air cover and just reassuring in respect of some rogue investigations, then we're very happy to do that.
Brilliant, thank you. Well, that's a really nice note to finish on, that sort of collaboration, communication and understanding between primary and secondary care. So thank you so much for joining me, Matt and Richard. It's been fascinating and I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Charlie. It's been a pleasure.
Well, that was a really interesting episode. So much useful information from Matt and Richard. And just hearing what they've done is really inspiring, really exciting, that actually we can collaborate better between primary and secondary care if we break down those barriers and increase and improve communication between primary and secondary care. We touched on some of those concerns that GPs and primary care may have about work being pushed back onto primary care. And Matt and Richard really talked a lot about how they try to really engage with the local community, and they'd also worked really hard to make sure that what they deliver is not pushing work back, but actually working with primary care to improve the patient experience and improve patient care and pathways. And it really came across that that was their intention during this episode. It was also really nice to hear how they had really tried to engage really well with primary care colleagues, and it sounded and felt like they really sort of understood the challenges and understood some of the facilitators for change, and I felt that that was really prominent in what we were talking about today. I'm personally a really firm believer that we can't make the system work better unless we really work together across the entire system. And really, this episode has demonstrated how in Northumbria, a really forward-thinking group of secondary care clinicians are trying to do that, which is really nice to hear. I always finish these episodes by trying to pull out some really key learning points that I've taken away from an episode. And I've got some really good ones, which I'm going to take away into my clinical practice. I guess the two main ones for me would be about when putting in an advice and guidance request, really make it clear what the question is that you're asking so that the secondary care team can approach and answer that question for you. So really thinking about, why am I putting this request in? What is it that I'm hoping to answer here? The second thing is thinking about actually some context to your query, because actually in primary care, we probably do know the patient best. We understand their social situation, their clinical background, and actually trying to put some of this information into an advice and guidance query can probably really help with decision making from secondary care. So all that remains for me to say is thank you very much for listening to this episode. We've got lots of great educational podcast episodes on Ingest, so please do have a listen to some of the other episodes that we've recorded. We'll be bringing out more in the near future, covering a range of topics, looking at pediatric abdominal pain and the management of irritable bowel syndrome. Do click subscribe and then you'll be notified whenever we upload an episode, which we aim to do every month. But sometimes it happens every 2 months, but I try and get one up every month for you. But do click subscribe and then you'll be notified when it is put up. Any feedback is always much appreciated. You can always make contact with the Primary Care Society for Gastroenterology if you have ideas about episodes or want to provide any other feedback around the series. Thank you very much and I hope you have a lovely day.